We simply don't like the Cambridge scholars. Nasty little upstarts, thinking they can make it on their own. No one goes to Cambridge unless they can't find a job here, Professor Chakravarti said. Sad.
Robin cast them an amazed look. Are you telling me this country's going to fall because of academic territoriality?
Well, yes. Professor Kraft lifted her teacup to her lips. It's Oxford. What did you expect?
Still, Parliament refused to cooperate. Every night the Foreign Office sent them the same telegram, always worded in precisely the same way, as if shouting a message over and over again could induce obedience. Cease, strike, now, stop. In a week, these offers stopped including an offer of amnesty. Shortly after that, they came with a rather redundant threat attached. Cease, strike, now, stop. Or army will take back the tower, stop. Very soon, the effects of their strike became deadly.
Abel brought them a running stream of gruesome updates. On the Charwell, a houseboat collided with a transport barge when the navigation systems of both failed, causing a steaming pileup in the middle of the river. 3 people died, trapped in submerged cabins. Up in Jericho, a 4-year-old child was crushed under the wheels of a carriage which ran amok. Out in Kensington, a 17-year-old girl and her lover were buried alive when the ruins of a church tower collapsed above them during a midnight tryst.
One of the major breaking points, it turned out, was the roads. In Oxford, but even more so in London, traffic was the dominant problem facing city officials. How to manage the flow of carts, horses, pedestrians, stagecoaches, hackney carriages and wagons without gridlock or accidents. Silverwork had kept pileups at bay by reinforcing wooden roads, regulating turnpikes, reinforcing toll gates and bridges, ensuring smooth turns by carts, replenishing the water pumps meant for suppressing dust, and keeping horses docile. Without Babel maintenance, all of these minute adjustments began to fail one by one, and dozens died as a result. Transportation tipped the domino that led to a slew of other miseries. Grocers could not stock their shelves. Bakers could not obtain flour. Doctors could not see their patients. Solicitors could not make it to court. A dozen carriages in London's richer neighbourhoods had made use of a match pair by Professor Lovell that played on the Chinese character Fu, which meant to help or to assist. The character had originally referred to the protective sidebars on a carriage. Professor Lovell had been due in London to touch them up mid-January. The bars failed. The carriages were now too dangerous to drive.
On a Wednesday, 2 carts collided, one of which was loaded with barrels of fine brandy. When the sweet fumes leaked out onto the street, a small crowd of bystanders rushed in to scoop up the brandy with their hands, and it was all good fun until a man with a lit pipe walked into the fray, turning the street into a conflagration of people, horses, and exploding barrels.
Everything they knew would transpire in London was already happening in Oxford. For Oxford, by proximity to Babel, was the most silver-reliant city in the world. And Oxford was rotting. Its people were going broke. They were hungry. Their trades had been interrupted. Their rivers were blocked up. Their markets had shut down. They sent out to London for food and supplies. But the roads had become perilous. And the Oxford to Paddington line was no longer running. The attacks on the tower redoubled. Townspeople and soldiers together crowded the streets, shouting obscenities at the windows, skirmishing with men at the barricades. But it made no difference. They could not hurt the translators, who were the only people who could end their misery. They could not get past the tower's wards, could not burn it down or set explosives at its base. They could only beg the scholars to stop. "We only have 2 demands," Robin wrote in a series of pamphlets, which had become his way of responding to the town's outcries. "Parliament knows this. Refusal to go to war and amnesty. Your fate lies in their hands." He requested that London capitulate before all these things came to pass. He hoped and knew they would not. He had fully converted now to Griffin's theory of violence, that the oppressor would never sit down at the negotiating table when they still thought they had nothing to lose. No. Things had to get bloody. Until now, all threats had been hypothetical,
London had to suffer to learn. Victoire did not like this. Every time they ascended to the eighth floor, they quarrelled over which resonance bars to pull out, and how many. He wanted to deactivate 24. She wanted only 2. Usually, they settled on 5 or 6.
"You're pushing things too fast," she said. "You haven't even given them a chance to respond."
"They can respond whenever they like," said Robin. "What's stopping them? Meanwhile, the army's already here."
"The army's here because you pushed them to it."
He made an impatient noise.
"Oh, I'm sorry I won't be squeamish. I'm not being squeamish. I'm being prudent."
Victoire folded her arms.
"It's too fast, Robin. It's too much all at once. You need to let the debate settle. You need to let public opinion turn against the war." "It's not enough," he insisted. "They won't reason themselves into justice now when they never have before. Fear's the only thing that works. This is just tactics. This is not coming from tactics."
Her voice sharpened.
"It's coming from grief."
He couldn't turn around. He didn't want her to see his expression.
"You said yourself you wanted this place to burn." "But even more," said Victoire, placing a hand on his shoulder. "I want us to survive."
It was impossible to say in the end how much of a difference the pace of their destruction really made. The choice remained with Parliament. The debates continued in London. No one knew what was going on inside the House of Lords, except that neither the Whigs nor the Radicals felt good enough about their numbers yet to call a vote. The papers revealed more about public sentiment. The mainstream rags expressed the opinion Robin had expected, which was that the war on China was a matter of defending national pride, that invasion was nothing more than a just punishment for the indignities imposed by the Chinese on the British flag, that the occupation of Babel by foreign-born students was an act of treason, that the barricades in Oxford and the strikes in London were the work of brutish malcontents, and that the government ought to hold firm against their demands. Prower editorials stressed the ease with which China would be defeated. It would only be a little war, and not even a proper war at that. All it took was the ignition of several cannons, and the Chinese would admit defeat within a day. The papers could not seem to make up their minds about the translators. The Prower publications offered a dozen theories. They were in cahoots with the corrupt Chinese government. They were co-conspirators of mutineers in India. They were malicious ingrates with no agenda at all, except a desire to hurt England, to bite the hand that had fed them. And this required no further explanation, for it was a motive that the British public were all too ready to believe.
"We will not negotiate with Babel,"
promised members of Parliament on both sides.
"Britain does not bow to foreigners."
The papers always referred to the strikers as foreign, as Chinamen, Indians, Arabs and Africans. Never mind Professor Kraft. They were never Oxfordians. They were never Englishmen. They were travellers from abroad who had taken advantage of Oxford's good graces and who now held the nation hostage. Babel had become synonymous with foreign, and this was very strange, because before this, the Royal Institute of Translation had always been regarded as a national treasure, a quintessentially English institution. But then England and the English language had always been more indebted to the poor, the lowly, and the foreign than it cared to admit. The word vernacular came from the Latin verna, meaning house slave. This emphasized the nativeness, the domesticity of the vernacular language. But the root verna also indicated the lowly origins of the language spoken by the powerful. The terms and phrases invented by slaves, labourers, beggars and criminals, the vulgar cants, as it were, had infiltrated English until they became proper. And the English vernacular could not properly be called domestic either, because English etymology had roots all over the world. Almanacs and algebra came from Arabic, pyjamas from Sanskrit, ketchup from Chinese, and paddies from Malay. It was only when elite England's way of life was threatened that the true English, whoever they were, attempted to excise all that had made them.
Yet, not all the papers were against Babel or for the war.
Indeed, for every headline that urged swift action in Canton, there was another by a publication, albeit smaller, more niche, more radical, that called the war a moral and religious outrage. The Spectator accused the Prower Party of greed and profiteering. The Examiner called the war criminal and indefensible. Jardine's Opium War a disgrace, read one headline by the Champion. Others were not so tactful. Druggy McDruggy wants his thumbs in China, read the Political Register. Every social faction in England had an opinion. The abolitionists put out statements of support for the strikers. So too did the suffragists, though not quite so loudly. Christian organisations printed pamphlets criticising the spread of an illegal vice to an innocent people, though the Prower evangelists responded with the supposedly Christian argument that it would in fact be God's work to expose the Chinese people to free trade. Meanwhile, radical publications made the argument that the opening up of China was antithetical to the interests of workers in northern England. The Chartists, a movement of disillusioned industrial and artisanal workers, came out most strongly in support of the strikers. The Chartist circular, The Red Republican, in fact, put out a headline calling the translators heroes of the working class. This gave Robin hope. The radicals were, after all, the party that the Whigs needed to appease. And if such headlines could convince the radicals that war was not in their long-term interests, then perhaps all this could be resolved. And indeed, the conversation about the dangers of civil work had fared better in the court of public opinion than did the conversation about China. Here was an issue that was close to home, that affected the average Briton in ways he could understand. The silver industrial revolution had decimated both the textile and agricultural industries. The papers ran piece after piece exposing the horrific working conditions inside silver-powered factories, although these had their rebuttals, including one refutation by Andrew Ure, who argued that factory workers would feel a good deal better if they only consumed less gin and tobacco. In 1833, the surgeon Peter Gaskell had published a thoroughly researched manuscript entitled The Manufacturing Population of England, focusing chiefly on the moral, social, and physical toll of silverworking machinery on British labourers. It had gone largely unheeded at the time, except by the radicals, who were known to exaggerate everything. Now the anti-war papers ran excerpts from it every day, reporting in grisly detail the coal dust inhaled by small children forced to wriggle into tunnels that adults could not, the fingers and toes lost to silver-powered machines working at inhuman speeds, the girls who'd been strangled by their own hair caught in whirring spindles and looms. The Spectator printed a cartoon illustration of emaciated children being crushed to death under the wheels of some nebulous contraption, which they captioned, "White Slaves of the Silver Revolution." In the Tower, they laughed themselves silly over this comparison, but the general public seemed genuinely horrified. Someone asked a member of the House of Lords why he supported exploiting children in factories. He replied quite flippantly that employing children under the age of 9 had been outlawed in 1833, which led to more general outcry over the suffering of 10 and 11-year-olds in the country. "Is it really as bad as all that?" Robin asked Abel. "The factories, I mean."
"Worse," said Abel. "That's just the freak accident they're reporting on. But they don't say what it's like to work day after day on those cramped floors, rising before dawn and working until 9 with few breaks in between. And those are the conditions we covet, the jobs we wish we could get back. I imagine they don't make you work half as hard at university, do they?"
"No," said Robin, feeling embarrassed. "They don't." The Spectator story seemed to greatly affect Professor Kraft in particular. Robin found her sitting with it at the tea table, red in the eyes, long after the others had finished their breakfast. She hastily wiped her eyes with a handkerchief when she saw him approach. He sat down beside her. "Are you all right, Professor?"
"Oh, yes."
She cleared her throat, paused, then nudged the paper.
It's a side of the story we don't often think about, isn't it?"
"I think we all got good at choosing not to think about certain things." She seemed not to hear him. She stared out of the window at the green below, where the strikers' protest grounds had been turned into what looked like a military camp.
"My first patented match pair improved the efficiency of equipment at a mine in Tyneshire," she said. "It kept coal-laden trolleys firmly on their tracks. The mine owners were so impressed. They invited me up for a visit, and of course I went. I was so excited about contributing something to the country. I remember being shocked at all the little children in the pits. When I asked, the miners said that they were completely safe, and that helping out in the mines kept them from trouble when their parents were at work. She took a shaky breath. Later they told me that the silver work made the trolleys impossible to move off the tracks, even when there were people in the way. There was an accident. One little boy lost both his legs. They stopped using the match pair when they couldn't figure out a workaround, but I didn't give it a second thought. By then I'd received my fellowship. I had a professorship in sight, and I'd moved on to other, bigger projects. I didn't think about it. I simply didn't think about it for years and years and years. She turned back towards him. Her eyes were wet. Only it builds up, doesn't it? It doesn't just disappear. And one day you start prodding at what you've suppressed. And it's a mass of black rot. And it's endless. Horrifying. And you can't look away.
Jesus Christ, said Robin. Victoire glanced up. What is it?
They were holed up in an office on the sixth floor, poring through the ledgers to find portents of future disasters. They'd already been through the Oxford Town appointments up to the next year. London's maintenance schedules were harder to find. Babel's bookkeeping was astonishingly bad, and the categorization system used by its clerks seemed not to be organized by date, which would have been logical, or by language, which would have made less, but at least some sense, but by the postal code of the London neighborhood in question. Robin tapped his ledger.
I think we might be close to a breaking point.
Why? They're due for maintenance on Westminster Bridge in a week. They've contracted for civil work at the same time that the new London Bridge was built in 1825, and the bars were meant to expire after 15 years. That's now.
So, what happens? Asked Victoire.
The turnstiles lock in?
I don't think so. It was quite a major... F is code for foundation, isn't it?
Robin trailed off, then fell silent. His eyes darted up and down the ledger, trying to confirm what was in front of him. It was quite a large entry, a list of silver bars and match pairs in various languages that stretched nearly half a page. A good number of them had corresponding numbers in a subsequent column, an indication they employed resonance links. He turned the page, then blinked. The column continued over the next two pages.
I think it just falls right into the river.
Victoire leaned back and exhaled very slowly, deflating. The implications were enormous. Westminster Bridge was not the only bridge to cross the Thames, but it saw the heaviest traffic. And if Westminster Bridge fell into the river, then no steamers, no houseboats, no sculls or canoes would be able to get around the wreckage. If Westminster Bridge went down, the whole city stopped moving. And in the weeks to come, when the bars that kept the Thames clean of sewage and pollution from gas factories and chemical works at last expired, the waters would revert to a state of disease and putrid fermentation. Fish would float belly up to the surface, dead and stinking. Urine and feces, already moving sluggishly through sewer drains, would solidify. Egypt would suffer her 10 plagues. But as Robin explained this, Victoire's face mirrored none of his glee. Rather, she was looking at him with a very odd expression, brows furrowed and lips pursed, and it turned his insides with discomfort.
It's Armageddon, he insisted,
spreading his hands in the air.
How could he make her see? It's the worst possible thing that could happen.
I know, she said. Except once you've played it, we've nothing left.
We won't need anything else, he said. We only need to turn the screws once, to push them to the limit.
A limit you know they'll ignore?
Please, Robin. Then what's the alternative? Defanging ourselves? It's giving them time. It's letting them see the consequences. What more is there to see?
He had not meant to yell. He took a deep breath.
Victoire, please. I just think we need to escalate, otherwise... I think you wanted to fall, she accused. I think this is just retribution for you, because you want to see it fall. And why not?
They'd had this argument before. The ghosts of Antony and Griffin loomed between them. One guided by the conviction that the enemy would at least act in rational self-interest, if not altruism, and the other guided less by conviction, less by telos, and more by sheer, untrammeled rage.
I know it hurts.
Victoire's throat pulsed.
I know it feels impossible to move on. But your motivating goal cannot be to join Rami.
A silence. Robin considered denying this, but there was no point lying to Victoire or to himself.
Doesn't it kill you?
His voice broke.
Knowing what they've done. Seeing their faces. I can't imagine a world where we coexist with them. Doesn't it split you apart? Of course it does, she cried. But that's no excuse not to keep living. I'm not trying to die. What do you think making this bridge collapse does then? What do you think they'll do to us?
What would you do? He asked.
End this strike? Open up the tower? If I tried, she said. Could you stop me?
They both stared at the ledger. Neither of them spoke for a very long time. They did not want to follow this conversation where it might lead. Neither of them could bear any more heartbreak.
A vote,
Robin proposed at last, unable to take this any longer.
We can't just break the strike like this. It's not up to us. Let's not decide, Victoire.
Victoire's shoulders sagged. He saw such sorrow on her face. She lifted her chin, and for a moment he thought she might argue further. But all she did then was nod. The vote came out narrowly in Robin's favour. Victoire and the professors were against. All the students were for. The students agreed with Robin that they had to push Parliament to the breaking point. But they were not thrilled about it. Ibrahim and Juliana both hugged their arms against their chest as they voted, as if shrinking from the idea. Even Yusuf, who usually took great pleasure in helping Robin compose threatening pamphlets to London, stared down at his feet.
So that's that, said Robin.
He'd won, but it did not feel like such a victory. He could not meet Victoire's eye.
When does this happen?
Professor Chakravarti asked.
This Saturday, Robin said. The timing's marvellous.
But Parliament isn't going to capitulate by Saturday.
Then I suppose we'll hear about the bridge when it's collapsed.
And you are comfortable with this? Professor Chakravarti glanced about, as if trying to gauge the moral temperature of the room. Dozens of people will die. There are whole crowds there trying to get on boats at all times of day. What happens when...
That's not our choice, said Robin. It's theirs. It's inaction. It's killing by letting die. We're not even touching the resonance rods. It's going to fall on its own.
You know very well that doesn't matter, said Professor Chakravarti. Don't mince the ethics. Westminster Bridge falling down is your choice. But innocent people can't determine the whims of Parliament.
But it's their government's duty to look out for them, said Robin. That's the entire point of Parliament, isn't it? Meanwhile, we don't have the option of civility or grace. It's an indiscriminate torch, I'll admit that, but that's what the stakes demand. You can't put the moral blame on me,
he swallowed.
You can't. You are the proximate cause, insisted Professor Chakravarti. You can make it stop.
But that's precisely the devil's trick, Robin insisted.
This is how colonialism works. It convinces us that the fallout from resistance is entirely our fault, that the immoral choice is resistance itself rather than the circumstances that demanded it.
Even so, there are lines you can't cross.
Lines! If we play by the rules, then they've already won.
You're trying to win by punishing the city, said Professor Chakravarti.
That means the whole city. Everyone in it. Men, women, children. There are sick children who can't get their medicine. There are whole families with no income and no source of food. This is more than an inconvenience to them. It's a death threat. I know, said Robin, frustrated. That's the point.
They glared at each other. And Robin thought he understood now the way that Griffin had once looked at him. This was a failure of nerve, a refusal to push things to the limit. Violence was the only thing that brought the colonizer to the table. Violence was the only option.
The gun was right there, lying on the table, waiting for them to pick it up. Why were they so afraid to even look at it?
Professor Chakravarti stood. I can't follow you down this path.
Then you ought to leave the tower,
Robin said promptly.
It'll help keep your conscience clear.
Mr. Swift, please listen to reason.
Turn out your pockets!
Robin raised his voice, speaking over the ringing in his ears.
Take nothing with you. Not silver, not ledgers, not notes you've written to yourself.
He kept waiting for someone to interrupt him, for Victoire to intervene, to tell him he was wrong. But no one spoke. He took this silence as tacit approval.
And if you leave, I'm sure you know you can't come back.
There is no path to victory here, warned Professor Chakravarti. This will only make them hate you. Robin scoffed.
They can't hate us any more than they do.
But no, that was not true. They both knew it. The British did not hate them, because hate was bound up with fear and resentment, and both required seeing your opponent as a morally autonomous being, worthy of respect and rivalry. The attitude the British held towards the Chinese was patronizing, was dismissive, but it was not hatred. Not yet. That might change after the bridge fell.
But then, Robin thought, invoking hatred might be good. Hatred might force respect. Hatred might force the British to look them in the eyes and see not an object, but a person.
Violence shocks the system, Griffin had told him, and the system cannot survive the shock.
Oderant dum metuant, he said.
Let them hate, so long as they fear.
That's our path to victory.
That's Caligula, said Professor Chakravarti. You're invoking Caligula.
Caligula got his way.
Caligula was assassinated.
Robin shrugged, wholly unbothered.
You know, said Professor Chakravarti, you know, one of the most commonly misunderstood Sanskrit concepts is ahimsa, non-violence.
I don't need a lecture, sir, said Robin, but Professor Chakravarti spoke over him.
Many think ahimsa means absolute pacifism, and that the Indian people are therefore a sheepish, submissive people who will bend the knee to anything. But in the Bhagavad Gita, exceptions are made for a dharma yuddha, a righteous war, a war in which violence is applied as the last resort, a war fought not for selfish gain or personal motives, but from a commitment to a greater cause. He shook his head.
This is how I have justified this strike, Mr. Swift. But what you're doing here is not self-defense. It is trespassed into malice. Your violence is personal. It is vindictive, and this I cannot support.
Robin's throat pulsed.
Then take your blood vial before you go, sir.
Professor Chakravarti examined him for a moment, nodded, and then began turning out the contents of his pockets onto the middle table. A pencil, a notebook, 2 blank silver bars. Everyone watched, silent. Robin felt a flash of irritation.
Would anyone else like to voice a complaint?
He snapped.
No one else said a word. Professor Kraft stood and walked away up the stairs. A moment later, Ibrahim joined her, then Juliana, and then the rest until only Robin and Victoire stood in the lobby, watching Professor Chakravarti stride down the front steps towards the barricades.
Chapter 29. How the chimney sweepers cry, every blackening church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. William Blake, London. The mood in the tower turned somber after Professor Chakravarti left. In the early days of the strike, they'd been too occupied with the exigencies of their situation, with pamphleteering, ledgers research, and barricade fortifications, to pay attention to the sheer danger they were in. It had all been so monumental, so unifying. They'd delighted in each other's company. They talked long into the nights, learning about one another, marvelling at how astonishingly similar their histories were. They'd been plucked from their motherlands at a very young age, thrown into England
and instructed to thrive or be deported. So many of them were orphans, all ties to their country severed except that of language.
But that was part of the genius of Babel. By keeping them isolated, by distracting them with coursework so that they never had the chance to form bonds outside their cohort, it had cut off all avenues towards meaningful solidarity, had made them believe for so long that they were the only ones caught in their particular web.
But the frantic preparations of those early days had now given way to gloomy, suffocating hours. All the pieces had been laid on the board. All hands were shown. They had no threats left to make, other than ones they'd already shouted from the rooftops. What stretched before them now was only time, a ticking down to the inevitable collapse. They'd issued their ultimatum, sent out their pamphlets. Westminster Bridge fell in 7 days, unless. This decision had left a bad taste in their mouths. They'd said all there was to say, and no one wanted to pick apart the implications. Introspection was dangerous. They only wanted to get through the day. Now, more often than not, they drifted to separate corners of the tower, reading or researching or doing whatever it was they did to make the time pass. Ibrahim and Juliana spent all their waking hours together. Sometimes the rest of them speculated whether the two might be falling in love. But they found they could never sustain that conversation. It made them think of the future, of how this might all end up, and that made them too sad. Yusuf kept to himself. Morgana occasionally took tea with Robin and Victoire, and they would exchange stories about their overlapping acquaintances. She graduated recently, and had been close to both Vimal and Anthony. But as the days drew on, she also started withdrawing into herself. And Robin wondered sometimes whether she and Yusuf were now regretting their decision to stay. Life in the tower. Life on strike. At first, so novel and strangely exciting, took on a routine, monotonous air. Things were hard going at first. It was both funny and embarrassing how little they'd learned about how to keep their living quarters in order. No one knew where the brooms were kept, so the floors remained dusty and littered with crumbs. No one knew how to do laundry. They tried producing a match pair using the word bleach and words derived from the Proto-Indo-European root bell, shining white, to flash, to burn. But all this did was temporarily turn their clothes white and scorching hot to the touch. They still congregated for meals 3 times a day on the hour, if only because that made rationing simpler. Their luxury items had quickly disappeared. There was no coffee after the first week. They were close to running out of tea by the second. Their solution to this was to dilute the tea more and more, until they were drinking little more than slightly discoloured water. There was no milk or sugar to speak of. Morgana argued they ought to just enjoy the last few teaspoons in a properly full brewed cup, but Professor Kraft vehemently disagreed. "I can give up milk," she said, "but I cannot give up tea." Victoire was Robin's anchor during that week. She was furious with him, he knew. The first 2 days they spent together in begrudging silence, but together still, because they needed each other for solace. They spent hours by the 6th floor window, sitting shoulder to shoulder on the floor. He did not press his point. She made no recriminations. There was nothing more to say. The course was set. By the 3rd day, the silence became unbearable. So they began to talk. Small nothings at first, and then everything that came to mind. Sometimes they reminisced about Babel, about the golden years before everything turned upside down. Sometimes they suspended reality, managed to forget everything that had happened, and gossiped about their college days as if the most important matter at hand was whether Colin Thornhill and the Sharp twins would get into fisticuffs over Bill Jameson's pretty visiting sister. It was 4 days before they could bring themselves to broach the subject of Letty. Robin did it first. Letty had lingered in the back of both their memories, like a festering sore they didn't dare touch, and he couldn't keep circling around it anymore. He wanted to take a burning knife and dig into the rot. "Do you think she was always going to turn on us?" he asked. "Do you think it was difficult for her, what she did?" Victoire didn't need to ask who he meant. "It was like an exercise in hope," she said after a pause.
Loving her, I mean. Sometimes I'd think she'd come around. Sometimes I'd look her in the eyes and think that I was looking at a true friend. And she'd say something, make some off-the-cuff comment, and the whole cycle would begin all over again. It was like pouring sand into a sieve. Nothing stuck. Do you think there's anything you could have said that might have changed her mind? I don't know, said Victoire. Do you? His mind did what it always did, which was to summon a Chinese character in lieu of the thought he was afraid of. When I think of Letty, I think about the character Z. He drew it in the air for her. It's most commonly used to mean a crack or a fissure. But in classical Chinese text, it also means a grudge or a feud. According to rumors, the Qing Emperor uses a bar engraved with a Z feud match pair installed under a stone mural of the imperial lineage. And when cracks appear, it shows that someone is plotting against him. He swallowed. I think those cracks were always there. I don't think there's anything we could have done about them. And all it took was pressure for the whole thing to collapse. You think she resented us that much? He paused, deliberating the weight and impact of his words. I think she killed him on purpose. Victoire observed him for a long moment before she responded, simply. Why? I think she wanted him dead, he continued hoarsely. You could see it on her face. She wasn't scared. She knew what she was doing. She could have aimed at any one of us. And she knew it was Rami she wanted. Robin. She loved him, you know, he said. The words came out of him like a torrent now. The floodgates were broken, and the waters could not be stopped. No matter how devastating, how tragic, he had to say it out loud, had to burden someone else with this awful, awful suspicion. She told me the night of the commemoration ball. She spent nearly an hour weeping into my shoulder because she wanted to dance with him, and he wouldn't even look at her. He never looked at her. He didn't. He had to stop. His tears threatened to choke him. Victoire gripped his wrist. Oh, Robin. Imagine that, he said. A brown man refuses an English rose. Letty couldn't bear that. The humiliation. He wiped his sleeve against his eyes. So, she killed him. Victoire said nothing for a long time. She gazed out over the crumbling city, thinking. At last, she pulled a rumpled piece of paper from her pocket and pressed it into his hand. You should have this. Robin unfolded it. It was the daguerreotype portrait of the four of them, folded and refolded so many times that thin white lines crisscrossed the image. But their faces were printed so clearly. Letty, glaring proudly, her face a bit strained after such a long time. Rami's hands affectionately on both her and Victoire's shoulders. Victoire's half-smile, chin tilted down, eyes raised and luminous. His own awkward shyness. Rami's grin. He took a sharp breath. His chest tightened, as if his ribs were constricting, squeezing his heart like a vice. He hadn't realized he could still hurt so much. He wanted to rip it to shreds, but it was the only remaining likeness he had of Rami.
I hadn't realized you kept it.
Letty kept it, said Victoire. She kept it framed in our room. I took it out the night before the garden party. I don't think she noticed.
We look so young.
He marveled at their expressions. It seemed like a lifetime had passed since they'd posed for that daguerreotype.
We looked like children. We were happy then.
Victoire glanced down, fingers tracing their fading faces.
I thought about burning it, you know?
I wanted the satisfaction. At Oxford Castle, I kept taking it out, studying her face, trying to see the person that would do this to us. But the more I look, the more I just feel sorry for her. It's twisted, but from her perspective, she must think she's the one who lost everything. She was so alone, you know? All she wanted was a group of friends, people who could understand what she'd been through, And she thought she'd finally found that in us. She took a shaky breath. And I suppose, when it all fell apart, I suppose she felt just as betrayed as we did.
Ibrahim, they noticed, spent a great deal of time writing in a leather-bound notebook. It's a chronicle, he told them when asked, of what happened inside the tower. Everything that was said, all the decisions that were made, everything we stood for. Would you like to contribute?
As a co-author?
Asked Robin. As an interview subject. Tell me your thoughts, I'll write them down. Perhaps tomorrow. Robin felt very tired. And for some reason, the sight of those pages of scribbles filled him with dread. I only want to be thorough, said Ibrahim. I've got Professor Crafts and the graduate fellow statements already. I just thought, well, if this all turns upside down.
You think we're going to lose? Said Victoire.
I think no one knows how this is going to end, said Ibrahim. But I know what they'll say about us if it ends badly. When those students in Paris died at the barricades, everyone called them heroes. But if we die here, no one's going to think we're martyrs. And I just want to make sure some record of us exists. A record that doesn't make us out to be the villains.
Ibrahim glanced at Robin. But you don't like this project, do you? Had he been glaring?
Robin hastily rearranged his face.
I didn't say that. You look repelled.
No, I'm sorry. I just...
Robin didn't know why he found it so hard to put the words together.
I suppose I just don't like thinking of us as history when we haven't even yet made a mark on the present.
We've made our mark, said Ibrahim.
We're already in the history books, for better or for worse. Here's a chance to intervene against the archives, no?
What sort of things are going in it?
Victoire asked.
Broad strokes only, or personal observations?
Anything you like, said Ibrahim. What do you have for breakfast, if you want? How you while away the hours?
But I'm most interested, of course, in how we all got here.
I suppose you want to know about Hermes, said Robin. I want to know everything you'd care to tell me.
Robin felt a very heavy weight on his chest then. He wanted to start talking, to spill out everything he knew and have it preserved in ink, but the words died on his tongue.
He didn't know how to articulate that the problem was not the existence of the record itself, but the fact that it wasn't enough, that it was such an insufficient intervention against the archives. That it felt pointless. There was so much to say, he didn't know where to begin. He had never thought before about the lacuna of written history they existed in, and the oppressive swath of denigrating narrative they fought against. And now that he did, it seemed insurmountable. The record was so blank. No chronicle of the Hermes Society existed at all, except this one. Hermes had operated like the best of clandestine societies, erasing its own history, even as it changed Britain's. No one would celebrate their achievements. No one would even know what they were. He thought of the old library, destroyed and dismantled, all those mountains of research locked away and hidden forever from view. He thought of that envelope, lost to ash, of the dozens of Hermes associates who'd never been contacted, who might never know what had happened. He thought of all those years Griffin spent abroad, fighting, struggling, railing against a system that was infinitely more powerful than he was. Robin would never know the full extent of what his brother had done, what he'd suffered. So much history erased. It just scares me, he said. I don't want this to be all we ever were. Ibrahim nodded to his notebook. Worth getting some of it down, then. It's a good idea. Victoire took a seat. I'll play. Ask me anything. Let's see if we can change some future historian's mind.
Perhaps we'll be remembered like the Oxford Martyrs, said Ibrahim.
Perhaps we'll get a monument.
The Oxford Martyrs were tried for heresy and burned at the stake, said Robin.
Ah, said Ibrahim, eyes twinkling. But Oxford's an Anglican university now, isn't it? Robin wondered in the days that followed if what they'd felt that night was a shared sense of mortality, akin to how soldiers felt sitting in trenches at war. For it was war, what was breaking out on those streets.
Westminster Bridge had not fallen, not yet. But the accidents continued, and the shortages grew worse. London's patience was strained. The public demanded retribution, demanded action, in some form or another. And since Parliament would not vote no on the China invasion, they simply increased their pressure on the army. It appeared the guardsmen had orders to leave the tower itself alone, but were permitted to aim at individual scholars when they got the chance. Robin stopped venturing outside when a rendezvous with Abel Goodfellow was interrupted by a spate of rifle fire. Once, a window shattered next to Victoire's head when she was searching the stacks for a book. They all dropped to the floor and crawled on hands and knees to the basement, where they were protected by walls on all sides. Later, they found a bullet lodged in the shelf just behind where she'd been standing.
"How is this possible?"
demanded Professor Kraft.
"Nothing penetrates these windows. Nothing gets through these walls."
Curious, Robin examined the bullet. Thick, warped, and unnaturally cold to the touch. He held it up to the light and saw a thin band of silver lining the base of the casing. I suppose Professor Playfair thought of something. That raised the stakes. Babel was not impenetrable. This was not a strike any longer, but a siege. If the soldiers broke through the barricades, if soldiers wielding Professor Playfair's inventions reached the front door, their strike was effectively over. Professor Kraft and Professor Chakravarti had replaced Professor Playfair's words on their first night in the tower, but even they admitted they were not as good at this as Professor Playfair had been. They were not sure how well their own defences would hold up. "Let's stay away from windows from now on," Victoire suggested. For now, the barricades held, though outside, the skirmishing had turned vicious. Initially, Abel Goodfellow's strikers had fought a purely defensive war from behind the barricades. They reinforced their structures, they ran supply lines, but they did not provoke the guardsmen. Now the streets had turned bloody. Soldiers fired regularly now on the barricaders, and the barricaders struck back in turn. They made incendiary devices with cloth, oil, and bottles, and hurled them at the army camps. They climbed the rooftops of the Radcliffe Library and the Bodleian, from which they threw paving stones and poured boiling water onto the troops below. It shouldn't have been so evenly matched, civilians against guardsmen. In theory, they shouldn't have lasted a week, but many of Abel's men were veterans, men discharged from an army falling into disrepair after the defeat of Napoleon. They knew where to find firearms. They knew what to do with them. The translators helped. Victoire, who'd been reading furiously through French dissident literature, composed a match pair, élan, energy, the latter of which bore connotations of a particular French revolutionary zeal, and which could be traced back to the Latin lancea, meaning lance. Carried through was an association with throwing and momentum, and it was this latent distortion into the English energy that helped the barricaders' projectiles fly further, hit truer, and make more of an impact than bricks and cobblestones ought to have been able to do. They'd come up with a few wilder ideas which bore no fruit. The word seduce came from the Latin seducere, meaning to lead astray, from which the late 15th century definition to persuade one to abandon their allegiance came about. This seemed promising, but they could not think of a way to manifest it without sending the girls into the front lines, which no one was willing to suggest, or dressing up Abel's men's in women's clothes, which seemed unlikely to work. There was also the German word Nachtmahr, a now rarely used word for nightmare, which also referred to a malicious entity that sat upon the sleeper's chest. Some experimentation proved this match pair made bad dreams worse when one had them, but seemed unable to induce them in the first place. One morning, Abel showed up in the lobby with several long, slender cloth-wrapped parcels.
"Can any of you shoot?" he asked.
Robin imagined aiming one of those rifles at a living body and pulling the trigger. He wasn't sure that he could do it.
"Not well."
"Not with those," said Victoire.
"Then let some of my men in there," said Abel. "You've got the best vantage point in the city. Pity if you don't use it."
Day after day, the barricades held.
Robin found it amazing that they didn't shatter under the weight of the near-constant cannon fire. But Abel was confident they could hold out indefinitely, as long as they kept scrounging up new materials to bolster the damaged sections.
"It's because we've built them in V-shaped structures," he explained. "The cannonballs hit the protrusion, which only packs the materials in more tightly."
Robin was skeptical. "They can't hold forever, though."
"No, perhaps not."
"And what happens when they come pouring through?" Robin asked. "Will you flee, or will you stay and fight?" Abel was quiet for a moment. Then he said,
"At the French barricades, revolutionaries would march up to the soldiers with their shirts open and shout at them to shoot if they dared."
"Did they?"
"Sometimes. Sometimes they shot them dead on sight. But other times, well, think about it. You're looking someone in the eyes. They're around your age or younger, from the same city, possibly the same neighbourhood. Possibly you know them. Or you see in their face someone you could know. Would you pull the trigger?"
"I suppose not," Robin admitted. Though a small voice in his mind whispered, "Letty did."
"Every soldier's conscience has a limit," said Abel. "I suppose they'll try to arrest us."
"But firing on townspeople?
Carrying out a massacre? I'm not so sure. But we'll force that split. We'll see what happens."
"It will all be over soon,"
they tried to reassure themselves at night when they looked out over the city, saw the torchlight and cannon fire burning bright. They needed only to hold out until Saturday. Parliament could not sustain this any longer than they could. They could not let Westminster Bridge fall. Then always, the strange, tentative imagining of what a ceasefire might look like. Should they write up a contract with terms of amnesty? Yusuf took charge of this, drafting a treaty that saved them from the gallows. When the tower resumed normal functioning, would they be a part of it? What did scholarship look like in the age after empire, when they knew Britain's silver stores would dwindle into nothing? They had never considered these questions before, but now, when the outcome of the strike stood on a razor's edge, their only comfort was in prognosticating the future in such detail that it seemed possible. But Robin couldn't bring himself to try. He couldn't bear those conversations. He excused himself whenever they occurred. There was no future without Rami, without Griffin, without Anthony, and Kathy, and Ilsa, and Vimal. As far as he was concerned, time had stopped when Letty's bullet had left the chamber. All there was now was the fallout. What happened after was for someone else to struggle through. Robin only wanted it all to end. Victoire found him on the rooftop, hugging his knees to his chest, rocking back and forth to the sound of gunfire. She sat down beside him.
"Bored with legal terminology?"
"It feels like a game," he said.
"It feels ludicrous. And I know this, all of this was ludicrous to begin with. But that, talking about after, just feels like an exercise in fantasy."
"You have to believe there's an after," she murmured.
"They did. They were better than us.
They were."
She curled around his arm.
"But it all still wound up in our hands, didn't it?"
Chapter 30. Westminster Bridge fell. London was sleeping when the bridge fell. London was still and unaware. Wizards Wordsworth wrote, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air, was wearing like a garment the beauty of the morning, silent, bare. Later, Oxford residents would claim that they too knew the moment that Westminster Bridge had fallen. This, despite the cities being over 100 miles apart, and there being no building tall enough to see London from that distance. Regardless, dozens of witnesses claimed, perhaps due to group hallucination, or perhaps an invisible effect of the resonance rods, that they heard it breaking before it collapsed. "It was this terrible feeling that gnawed at your gut," said Professor Harrison Lewis, Merton College, Natural Philosophy. "The most intense dread. You knew something was about to happen, and you only later learned what."
Eyewitness accounts from London herself described it as a great rumbling. Like the stones were screaming, said Mrs. Sarah Harris, washerwoman. They seemed to be telling you to get away, and heaven knows I listened. This was a city used to bridges falling into disrepair, mind. London Bridge had become unusable at least thrice in her history. Once by ice, and many times by fire. But London Bridge, despite the songs, had only ever partially collapsed. It had never fallen plumb into the water. Westminster Bridge did. It was so very clean, said Mr. Monk's Creedy, chimney sweep. One moment it was in the air, and then it wasn't. It did not fall without warning. Eyewitnesses reported that the stones grumbled for 20 minutes before, and this gave most pedestrians time to flee to either end. Two steamships were crossing beneath when the rumbling began, and both tried to clear the bridge, one by reversing and the other by accelerating ahead. The result was a traffic pileup that trapped both ships, and many other boats right beneath the bridge. It was like Jericho when the walls came down, said Mr. Martin Green, Esquire, Solicitor. It was so neat, like it all fell at the call of some invisible trumpet. The human toll remains under debate, for there is the uncertain number of pedestrians on the bridge at the moment of collapse. At least 63, including one MP who had in fact been against the war. The victims on the ships below, and those who died in the river accidents that followed. I saw a lady yelling by the bank, said Mrs. Sue Sweet, housekeeper. She was screaming for this houseboat to come and fetch her. Only the houseboat was too far away, and by the time she thought to run, the stones were upon her. When asked if she thought the fall of Westminster Bridge might advance the translator's cause, Mrs. Sweet said, No, I don't think they did this. No man could do this. Something like this could only be an act of God. Chapter 31. Westminster Bridge fell, and Oxford broke out in open warfare. They were crowded around a telegraph machine, waiting anxiously for an update, when one of the gunmen rushed in from upstairs and caught his breath before announcing, They've killed a girl. They followed him to the rooftop. With his naked eye, Robin could see a commotion up north in Jericho, a frenzied movement of the crowd. But it took a moment of fumbling with the telescope before he honed in on what the gunmen were pointing at. Soldiers and labourers at the Jericho barricade had just exchanged fire, the gunmen told them. Usually, this led to nothing. Warning shots echoed throughout the city at all times. And the sides usually took turns firing before retreating back down behind the barricades. Symbolic. It was all supposed to be symbolic. But this time, a body had toppled. The telescope lens revealed a startling amount of detail. The victim was young. She was white. She was fair-haired and pretty, and the blood blossoming from her stomach stained the ground a vivid, unmistakable scarlet. Against the slate-grey cobblestones, it looked like a flag. She wasn't wearing trousers. The women who'd joined the barricades usually wore trousers. She had on a shawl and a flowing skirt, and an upturned basket still hung from her left arm. She could have been on her way to buy groceries. She could have been on her way home to her husband, to parents, to children. Robin straightened up. Was it?
It wasn't us, said the other gunman. Look at the angle. She's turned away from the barricades. It wasn't one of ours, I tell you.
Shouts from below. Shots whistled above their heads, startled. They hurried back down the stairs into the safety of the tower. They congregated in the basement, huddled nervously, eyes darting around like frightened children who'd just done something very naughty. This was the first civilian casualty of the barricades, and it was momentous. The line had been breached.
It's over, said Professor Kraft. This is open warfare on English soil. This all needs to end.
A debate broke open then.
But it wasn't our fault, said Ibrahim.
They don't care if it's our fault, said Yusuf. We started it.
Then do we surrender? Demanded Meghana. After all this, we just stop?
We don't stop, said Robin. The strength of his voice stunned him. It came from someplace beyond him. It sounded older. It sounded like Griffin's. And it must have resonated, for the voice is quieted, and all faces turned towards him, scared, expectant, hopeful. This is when the tides turn. This was the most foolish thing they could have done. Blood thundered in his ears. Before, the whole city was against us, don't you see? But now the army's messed up. They've shot one of the townsfolk. There's no coming back from that. Do you think Oxford's going to support the army now? If you're right, Professor Kraft said slowly, then things are about to get much worse. Good, said Robin. As long as the barricades hold. Victoire was watching him with narrowed eyes, and he knew what she suspected. That this did not weigh on his conscience at all. That he wasn't nearly as distressed as the others. Well, why not admit it? He was not ashamed. He was right. This girl, whoever she was a symbol. She proved that Empire had no restraints, that Empire would do anything to protect itself. Go on, he thought. Do it again. Kill more of them. Turn the streets red with the blood of your own. Show them who you are. Show them their whiteness won't save them. Here, at last, was an unforgivable offence with a clear perpetrator. The army had killed this girl. And if Oxford wanted vengeance, there was only one way to get it. That night, Oxford's streets exploded into proper violence. The fighting started at the far end of the city, at Jericho, where the first blood was shed, and gradually spread as more and more points of conflict developed. The cannon fire was constant. The whole city was awake with shouts and rioting, and Robin saw in those streets more people than he had ever imagined lived in Oxford. The scholars clustered by the windows, peeking out in between spates of sniper fire. This is insane, Professor Kraft kept whispering. Absolutely insane. Insane was not enough to cover it, Robin thought. English was insufficient to describe all this. His mind wandered to old Chinese texts, the idioms they employed about dynastic collapse and change. Qian fan di fu. The heavens fell, and the earth collapsed in on itself. The world turned upside down. Britain was spilling its own blood. Britain was gouging out its own flesh, and nothing after this could go back to the way it had been before. At midnight, Abel summoned Robin to the lobby.
It's over, he said. We're nearing the end of the road.
What do you mean? Robin asked. This is good for us. They've provoked the entire city, haven't they?
It won't last, said Abel. They're angry now, but they're not soldiers. They've got no endurance. I've seen this before. By the early hours of the night, they'll start straggling home. And I've just had word from the army that at dawn, they'll start firing on whoever's still out there.
But what about the barricades? Robin asked, desperate. They're still up.
We're down to the last circle of barriers. High Street is all we've got. There's no pretense of civility any longer. They'll break through. It's not a question of if, but when. And the fact is, we're a civilian uprising and they're a trained armed battalion with reinforcements to spare. If history is anything to go by, if this really does become a battle, then we're going to get crushed. We aren't keen on a repeat of Peterloo.
The Peterloo Massacre of 1819, the largest immediate effect of which was to provoke a government crackdown on radical organising. The cavalry rushed a crowd agitating for parliamentary representation, crushing men, women and children alike under their hooves. 11 died.
Abel sighed. The illusion of restraint could only ever last so long. I hope we've bought you time.
I suppose they were happy to fire on you after all, said Robin.
Abel cast him a rueful look.
I suppose it doesn't feel good to be right.
Well then.
Robin felt a roil of frustration, but forced it down. It wasn't fair to blame Abel for these developments, nor was it fair to ask him to stay any longer, when all he would face was near certain death or arrest.
Thank you, I suppose. Thank you for everything.
Hold on, said Abel. I didn't come just to announce we were abandoning you.
Robin shrugged.
He tried not to sound resentful. It'll be over very quickly without those barricades.
I'm telling you, this is your chance to get out. We'll start ferrying people away before the shooting gets properly vicious. A few of us will stay to defend the barricades, and that will distract them long enough to get the rest out to the Cotswolds at least. No,